Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. At the end of last week, the 35-day partial government shutdown came to an end. But as it dragged on, it dealt a huge financial blow to many of the federal workers who went unpaid, like David Martinez, a correctional officer at FMC Devens.
I usually use my tax returns to carry me through a year as a saving. By the holidays, it expires, and then I'm in a little gap, and then I usually file my taxes early enough, so I don't have significant savings. That is easy to say. I do not.
So Martinez's story highlights an interesting point. Nearly 60% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings, leaving little money for a rainy day, let alone retirement. And that's a reality for millions of Americans. Gone are the days of thinking of decades of hard work will guarantee a relaxing and financially secure retirement. And it means potentially working long into old age. So how did we get here and what can we do about it? Catherine Newman aims to answer that question in her new book, Downhill from Here: Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality. She's the author of numerous books and currently serves as the interim chancellor of UMass Boston. Chancellor Newman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
So from the first words of your book to even the title, Downhill from Here, this isn't a happy story, so how bad are things?
It's not a happy story, and I would say things are pretty scary. For thousands of workers all around the country, white-collar, blue-collar, public, private, virtually nobody other than those at the very top of our income distribution have escaped this problem. And I hate to say this, Jamie, but it's not going to get easier for your generation, because if anything, you're looking at a weaker retirement structure than my generation. I'm sorry.
So maybe, well, I know folks can't see us in here. So I'm a millennial. What generation would you say?
I'm your baby generation. Boomer.
So who has it the worst?
Well, I don't think we've seen the worst of this, because the conditions of secure retirement have been unraveling for quite a while, and they're getting harder and harder as generations like yours found themselves with faltering entry into the labor market, couldn't get into the housing market, got hit by the recession in 2008. You put all that together, and I think, if anything, this message is more redolent for you. But the generations that are now either retired or headed for retirement are the first wave of people to discover life isn't quite what they planned, and it's not a happy discovery.
So you mentioned the Great Recession, but how else did we get to where we are?
Well, I think we started getting where we are back in the 1980s when we fell in love with deregulation. And all these industries were deregulated in the telecommunications, air traffic controllers, you name it. And as companies became more competitive, which was kind of the point of deregulation, many of them started going bankrupt and they started stopping funding their pension plans. And pretty soon you had a weakening of the pension plans. And so 20 or 30 years later, you see the fallout of deregulation from long, long ago. Then you add to that the Great Recession, which took out home equity as a source to protect people and hammered the stock market, which is where all those pension funds were invested. And now you've got an implosion in the pension funds. You've got bankruptcy in pension funds. And the pension guarantee system, which is a modest guarantee, a modest sort of insurance system, started getting hit hard. And it, too, may go bankrupt in the near future.
But you do hear the argument that deregulation did, on the other hand, help with great economic growth across the economy. I'm thinking of the airline industry. Yes, airlines went out of business, but it also spurred price wars and more competition, allowing more people to travel further for less. So I guess I'm wondering if this is just the other side of the coin of that economic growth that could have came from deregulation.
Well, I think what we've seen is that economic growth ended up with haves and have-nots, and what we're looking at are some of the have-nots. And ironically and sadly, in my opinion, many of those firms that went into bankruptcy and then emerged later on, like United Airlines, and are now just incredibly strong, never went back to the workers they abandoned and restored their pensions. They just walked away from them in bankruptcy court. I don't think that should be allowed, and it's happened to millions of American workers. The Teamsters in the Central States Pension Fund, 500,000 of them in the Midwest, totally at loss. So I think we've got a lot of public policy problems to think about. What is fair? What is just? And how do we shore this up for the future? Because it's wobbling pretty badly.
So you write early in your book about some of these Teamsters, truck drivers like Floyd Lanter and Butch Lewis and others, who were loyal to their companies. They worked many long, hard years, lived modest lifestyles, had faith that their pensions would keep them stable and secure in retirement. Who made that promise? And I guess my question is, how do we get that promise back?
Well, from their point of view, a whole bunch of actors made that promise. The companies they worked for, the pension funds that they invested in, the bankers who were managing those pension funds, government regulators who stood behind those guarantees, the Treasury Department. I mean, the list is very long of people that they're furious with as a result. How do we get that back? Well, we're going to have to lift the cap on Social Security, and there's a bill before Congress right now to do that. That would help the Social Security system become stable. But I also think we need to look again at where pension recipients fall in the line of creditors when a company starts to wobble. Right now, we privilege shareholders, and pension recipients are like at the back of the bus. Why is that? As far as I'm concerned, they are at least as entitled as any shareholder to consideration when a firm starts to wobble.
Could part of it be that people would much rather have a paycheck now versus thinking about retirement later?
Well, they don't think that's the choice they're making. They think they're doing both. I mean, in the case of the Teamsters, many of them gave back 10-15% of their wages in order to keep their firms afloat and were told that money would come back to them when they retired, and it just didn't. And this, I think, is really critical. If you make promises to people that are lasting over a 40-50-year period of their work lives, and then you say, sorry, we didn't really mean it, faith in democratic institutions suffers pretty dramatically. And I think this has contributed to a level of cynicism and despair in the country in general, because this is one of the longest promises we make to people. I mean, outside of marriage, I think it might be the longest.
At the same time, I am thinking of folks in the millennial generation who, maybe it's because it's set up this way for us to think that we're not going to work at the same company for our whole lives and get that pension. And you know, there's all this talk of millennials and their side hustles and their 3-4 different jobs. And is that, I guess I'm asking if that's a function of our generation, or is that us adapting to the reality that we're not going to have the type of retirement that maybe someone who worked at GE their entire career got?
I don't think anybody expects anymore for you or anyone else that you're going to work for the same company all of your lives. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be entitled to the pension that you've been earning all along the way. I mean, I have had the great privilege of working for 8 different universities, but I've carried retirement through because I'm part of TIA-CREF. Mm-hmm. Why isn't there a TIA-CREF for you as you move around? We do need to adapt these instruments to the changing nature of the labor market, but I can guarantee you a point will come when even this wonderful job at this great radio station won't be the job that you can count on anymore, and at that point, you are going to be looking for a pension. So just because you're young and vigorous now doesn't mean that day doesn't come. It comes for everybody.
So, okay, and in that case, I have paying into Social Security, which we could talk about. And, you know, there's a 401(3B), 401,
whatever. As long as you don't touch it, as long as you don't hit a rainy day when you have to raid it. But that's exactly what happened in 2008. These weaker instruments, which were never designed to be full-fledged pensions, they were always meant to be supplementary, have now become the main chance. They weren't designed for that, and they are more ratable. They fluctuate more. They depend on you making wise investments as opposed to defined benefit pension plans, which were the responsibility of employers to invest. So I think we need to look at that whole equation and ask whether or not this is a sustainable enterprise. I don't think it is.
So if it's not a sustainable enterprise, how do you – what do you view as a solution or a way to fix it?
Well, you know, other countries who are also facing aging populations have found better ways than we have. They do require some sacrifices. In those countries, especially in the Nordic countries, people pay much higher taxes. On the other hand, there's all kinds of things that they can depend on because they do pay higher taxes. So they tend not to segregate these funds entirely from the rest of the state budget in places like Denmark or the Netherlands. But they guarantee a much more robust pension. It's a combination in most of those countries of a stable state pension plus a pension that's defined benefit based on your earnings. And those are walled off in ways that are completely protected. And what's more, these countries put a lot more of their resources, their GDP resources, into the pension plans. Hence, they are secure from here to eternity, and ours are not. So, and there are parts of the United States that actually look better, too. I talk a lot in the book about Las Vegas, which may sound like a high roller place, but Las Vegas has a heavily unionized workforce. And as a result, they've been able to bargain for much more solid benefits, really up and down the wage scale. And that shows us that under certain conditions, high union density, relatively low competition because it's surrounded by a desert, there are places even in the U.S. that have much stronger pension systems than you might find in a more competitive economy like gambling in New Jersey.
Mm. But I'm also thinking, though, of sort of the argument made by some conservative economists. I'm thinking Diana Furchgott-Roth at Manhattan, who say that, you know, unions, you brought up unions, can actually make it worse for workers by focusing on higher wages today, as we talked about, versus retirement accounts. It's not popular to come back from a union negotiation and say, oh, we got us more retirement, but your pay is staying the same. So what's your response to those
arguments?
Well,
we had very long periods of American history where people had both. They had higher wages and better pensions, but union density is a big reason why they did. When you look at how inequality has unfolded, and I try to make an argument that inequality is part of this story, mm-hmm. when you look at who has really gained from the expansion in the American economy, it's gone almost entirely to the top 1%. Well, what if that were not so much the case? And of course, many young politicians are debating this now. Yeah. And more of those more of those resources ended up in workers' pockets and their pensions. So there are a lot of distributional questions that could be asked here.
So I want to get to a hopeful place here because it's Friday. When I think of working late into my old years, doesn't excite me. I love working, but I also would love to see the enjoyment and excitement that maybe my parents have or other folks who are retired have. And so give me some hope here.
Well, Jamie, I'm not super optimistic about your generation, but your children, maybe a slightly different story.
Okay.
In the Northeast in particular, but countrywide, we have seen a very sharp decline in birth rates. And that means we have small generations coming up. By 2026, here in the New England region, we will see a 25% drop in the college age population. That's a combination of declining birth rates over a long period of time, plus what happened during the Great Recession, when people basically just stopped having kids and stopped forming families. And that had a permanent effect so that by 2026, we see this birth dearth. When you have a much smaller generation, as long as there is an economy that's in reasonably good shape, you know what? Those workers are really valuable. Everybody starts bidding for them, and you will start to see benefits rise and wages rise just because the population dynamics will help to drive that. Now, that's a long way out, and it's not you, but I do think that these things are very sensitive to population dynamics. So what we see now isn't necessarily forever, but union density and the bargaining power that employees have is a big answer to how these benefits end up in somebody's pocket.
But so you're a college chancellor, and you mentioned college-age students here in New England, and I can't help think of the Mount Idas or the Hampshire colleges or the other schools that have been absorbed into institutions, Wheelock into BU, and think that this decline in college-age, you know, available students would also affect the economy here in New England.
It definitely will. And of course, this is a challenging time for people who are running small colleges with small endowments that are very tuition dependent. Public universities are in a different space. But I will say this, the conditions that affect people in my job who are running universities are almost the mirror opposite of what will happen to our students. Our students are going to be coveted by everyone. We are looking at unemployment rates now in Massachusetts that are about, 3.8%?
Hmm.
That's really low. And now project out those low demographics going forward, and it's going to get tighter and tighter. That's a great thing for young people. They will be sought after. Benefits will be higher because employers will have to bid for them. And as long as we in the universities can provide them with excellent training and they are good prospects, I actually think they're going to be in great shape. The university sector is going to have a shakeout.
So there's some hope there.
For some generations, yes. Okay. Not maybe not for you, Jamie.
That's okay. It wasn't meant for you to come in here and make me feel better about my future.
Well,
but
it's
I do
Friday.
Appreciate
I want you to feel better.
Okay. Well, Catherine Newman is the author of Downhill From Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality, and numerous other books. She's the interim chancellor of UMass Boston. She'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. There's more details at our website, radioboston.org. Chancellor Newman, thank you so much for bringing this important topic to our show today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.